You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Real Vision. It's Wednesday, November 11, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Jack Farley.
Thanks, Ash. Markets resumed their ascent today with the tech-dominated NASDAQ leading the way. The announcement of the Pfizer vaccine continues to shape markets in ways that are evolving. The vaccine needs to be stored and transported at extremely cold temperatures, as low as negative 90 degrees Fahrenheit, in fact. So we're seeing deep freezing corporations and vaccine logistic companies having a monumental rally, companies like Daihan Scientific and Snowman Logistics. One sector that went on a tear on Monday's vaccine news was the movie exhibitors. Their sales had been absolutely obliterated by shutdowns. You look at AMC's third quarter, their sales were down 91% year over year, but the prospect of a vaccine has breathed new life into this industry whose future is on the knife's edge. Cinemark and Cineworld are holding firm today, but AMC is actually down 11% today as doubts about their liquidity heighten. AMC is the largest exhibitor in the US and a staple of American life. Corona cases in the US are up 69% over the past 2 weeks, and deaths are up 23%. And in New York, the case fatality rate is 2.31%. If it goes to 3%, all public schools are going to go remote. As we enter this winter of profound uncertainty, companies are looking to buffer their balance sheet, whether it's debt or equity. They're grasping for as much cash as they can get their hands on. Carnival Cruises and American Airlines announced plans on Tuesday to issue additional equity, and speculative-grade corporates are tapping the high-yield bond markets, companies like Antero, Continental, and Tervita. By the way, AMC, which had issued equity last month, is now double-dipping, offering 20 million additional shares to the market. It makes sense for these corporates. Credit spreads have continued to sink, both in investment grade and high yield, with lenders all too happy to oblige companies' need for cash. It makes sense. Bill Ackman of Pershing Square just announced he put back on his short of investment grade credit. That should be interesting to watch going forward. Is Bill Ackman someone you want us to interview on Real Vision? Let us know in the comments below. By the way, all this risk-on sentiment over the past week has dealt a minor blow to the U.S. Treasury market. Yields have risen as much as 20 basis points on the long end of the curve. ETFs like TLT are taking their medicine, but hey, the money has to come from somewhere, right? Meanwhile, on the European continent, the head of the EU's unit on winding down failing banks is sounding the alarm about non-performing loans. Elke Koenig, chair of the Single Resolution Board, is urging European banks to, quote, be aware that non-performing loans are coming and that the best thing to do is address them early. That is the best thing that we can do for the time being. And after that, it's steering through the fog. The European Central Bank has continued to pursue vigorous intervention in the money market funds, even after the Fed and the BOJ have wound down those programs. Whether the ECB has an appetite for supporting up to 1.5 trillion euros in sour loans, we'll see. By the way, before I let you go, over the next 2 weeks, we're going to do an interview series that might change the way you look at markets. It's perhaps the best series of interviews that we've done in the history of Real Vision. We all know that we're in an uncertain territory. The fate of this virus and how it impacts economic behavior, it's very up in the air. Fiscal stimulus overdue, central banks scrambling to pay for the cracks, markets at all-time highs. We all know this. You know this. But how do you make sense of this? No one knows that. So over the next two weeks, we're going to be speaking to the best investors in the world, the brightest financial minds, to help answer this question for you and your portfolio. So Brent Johnson is going to be speaking to Russell Napier, Rao's talking to Real Vision favorite Hugh Hendry, Kirill Sokolov's going to be interviewing investing legend Sam Zell, Mike Green talking to the world's most accomplished short seller, Jim Chanos, Jim Grant is coming back to speak to William White about the state of central banking, Kyle Bass interviewing a forensic accountant, Steve Clapham, who's done a deep dive in the weeds on Chinese tech stocks. I mean, my God, Rao's talking to Chamath Palihapitiya. I mean, what? Even I have trouble believing it. I mean, I might have to pinch myself. So it starts next week, next Monday, although this Friday you might have a little surprise. So stay tuned for that. And with that, let's go over to Ash and Ed.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Thanks, Jack. Welcome back, Ed.
Thank you, and happy Veterans Day to you, the real Veterans Day.
And happy real Veterans Day to you, and thank you for your service, Ed.
Thank you. And, you know, by the way, given the fact that we just listened to Jack Hollywood Farley, I just wanted to give him a shout out because tomorrow, I understand he's going to be the host of this show, sitting in your chair, if you will.
Sitting in my chair, but 15 blocks further south.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You know, talking of Jack, he had some really interesting stories in the intro that I think kind of bring up some of the issues that we've been talking about a little bit more broadly, a little bit more structurally. The EU is urging banks to begin preparing for NPLs, those are non-performing loans. U.S. companies are continuing to stockpile progressively more cash. And finally, there's a story out today that Bill Ackman is talking about too much complacency in markets, once again, shorting investment-grade credits, which is very similar to the bet he made last time, where he made $2.6 billion, I believe, earlier in the year on the declines in economic activity from the COVID crisis. Ed, you've been thinking about this big picture for a very long time. You've been talking about the potential for a double dip. Where are you in terms of your framework right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we spoke to that, and I there are so many ideas that are going through my mind right now after the election, you know, because we obviously had that COVID-related sell-off because of what happened in Europe in terms of the lockdowns. And I think that was appropriate given the fact that Europe is such a large contributor to global GDP growth and that they were going and doing the most draconian thing, locking down their economies. But then the secondary question is what happens in the US? And I'm definitely firmly of the belief on two fronts. One, that the backward looking data in the US are good. That is that we're looking at numbers that suggest that the U.S. looks good to be able to power forward. It would be good if it weren't for the virus. The second is that the virus is a big problem. I think that the things that you and I were talking about maybe 2 weeks ago have been borne out by reality. That is that the numbers in the U.S., I said, are definitely going to rise. They're going to rise a lot. And it's going to be epidemic proportions. And what we've seen since that time is an absolute, you know, mushrooming in the case count. The death count is up to 1,400 today. The highest that we saw was in the 2,000 range in the first wave. So I honestly think that we'll get to those levels. I was talking around the 1,500 level. We're already near that level now. So things are looking really bad. And the question is for the U.S., given the fact that we haven't had a lockdown yet, will there be a lockdown eventually? And what sort of economic outcome can we expect, given that we already expect bad things to happen in Europe?
Yeah. You know, Ed, inspired by your thoughts, let's do a quick chart storm just to give visual form to some of these ideas, because they're such an incredibly important part of what we're looking at right now. So starting out first, this is just the daily trend in the number of COVID cases in the U.S. You can see once again up and to the right. There's, you know, there are three peaks. The third one is the highest. That's where we are now. Disturbingly, here is the daily trends in the number of deaths from COVID. You can see there looks like there's some periodization in the data. That looks to me like weekend lull in reporting. But the important thing is at the end of this chart, you can see there's a huge leg up in the number of people who are dying. And that, as a consequence, is pushing that moving average, that's the red line, ever higher. Here's a chart that, or rather a map, I should say, that I found to be really unusual. If you look at the highest rates of hospitalization, that's the red areas that you're looking at, it's Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska. These are places that were not hard hit in the first wave. And you can see here in New York, which obviously was hit very hard, in the lowest zone in terms of the number of hospitalizations per million cases. You know, to jump internationally, to your point about Europe, this chart, I think, very disconcerting. This is Europe's COVID-19 resurgence. You can see this chart is kind of unusually formed, but it's effectively aggregating together the global regions where COVID has hit, which is effectively the whole world. And what you can see is this huge bulge in the chart on the left. That's the first wave where you have Europe, and then a little bit later shifted slightly to the right, North America. And now, once again, Europe picking up dramatically, precisely to your point, Ed. And for me, the most disconcerting of all of these charts for Americans, it's called false surge. And here you can see the surge in hospitalization from coronavirus cases, now up to a new daily high number of people admitted to the hospital. So the narrative that we'd heard from people who were a little bit more optimistic had basically two main points. The first was that it was an unmasking effect caused by additional testing that was causing those numbers to look higher than they were. And the second was that younger and healthier people were getting it and there was going to be less impact because it was people who were out and about and not in nursing homes. It seems, looking at those, that last chart, the hospitalization chart, that both of those thoughts are suspect. This looks like a very significant problem.
Yeah, and I would say, one, you're being diplomatic, charitable. I mean, they were just completely off, right? They had blinders on because they didn't want to see what was in front of them. Yes, it is true that we're testing more. And two, by the way, even if you're hospitalized, you know, the hospitalization rate to the death rate is actually lower as well.
Yeah.
So, the truth of the matter is that we're much better at dealing with this. But that doesn't mean that we aren't seeing an epidemic increase. When you see the levels of increase in terms of the actual numbers of cases, all you need is directionality. You don't really need, it's not the actual numbers themselves that matter. It's the direction that they're going and over what time scale that's happening. So when numbers are increasing in terms of the counts by 60%, eventually you're going to catch up in terms of the death count as well. So that's really what you have to say. And we're still continuing to increase in terms of the actual testing numbers, the number of people who are tested positive. So you can see that the death counts will actually, with a lag, increase continuously. That's really the whole concept of looking at flow, at looking at the trend as opposed to the absolute numbers, which is what I generally tend to do in terms of economic data as well. So the big question is what does that mean in terms of the economy? Because, you know, from what I've seen, certainly, and just in my area, it's been a ghost town at night. So there has been, you know, a palpable change in terms of people's behavior at the margin in terms of certain things. And so it's interesting when you think about the vaccine coming on board and the massive reaction we had to the vaccine. The question is what are we supposed to make of the price action in markets? You know, you have the stay-at-home stocks, and then you have the beaten down value stocks, and there's been a rotation trade there. My view is that what we've definitely seen is that the prevailing view that the new normal that we've been living in was going to continue, it was probably overplayed. That there's a reversion to the mean, if you will, in terms of how once the vaccine comes on board, we're going to unwind some of the behaviors that we've been engaged in. But I think that we're not going to unwind them completely. So some of the, you know, the things that I'm already seeing in my local area in terms of, you know, at night, people not going out to bars, not going out to restaurants, those are the kinds of things that I think will continue to go on as long as the pandemic is still a problem, and probably even after the fact. So there's going to be, you know, a reversion to what we used to have, the old normal, but it's not going to go completely in that direction. And the question is what happens in the interim in terms of how much damage is it going to do to certain parts of the economy? I think that there are parts of the economy, small businesses, leisure, hospitality and travel, that will get hit. And some of those companies will go bankrupt. We already have a shutdown in Europe. So Norwegian Air is a perfect example of this. This is a company that required a bailout from the Norwegian government. If they don't, if things don't improve quickly by the beginning, by the winter of 2021, they're going to hit the wall and they'll have to be liquidated. I think you'll see similar types of companies here in the United States as well.
Yeah, so much there, Ed, to dig into. You touched on something that I very much wanted to ask you about, which is this rotation and counter-rotation. I'll be diplomatic again. That doesn't really seem to have a great deal of direction or cohesion between growth and value. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm thinking about it in terms of the reversion to the mean as well. I saw something that Kevin Muir from the Macro Tourist, what he was writing. He said the Monday rotation trade was the biggest outperformance of value over growth since 2001. And we know, you know, that 2000 to 2002 period was a massive outperformance of value after we had the bubble of the internet, which came to a halt. You had people like Julian Robertson, his Tiger Fund. This is something that Kevin Muir mentioned closing down. Similar sorts of things are happening now. And so his postulation is that even though we're giving back some of this rotation, just because, as I said, you know, you have a reversion to the mean in terms of certain things, there is potentially a durable shift here, that we were way over our skis in terms of the large cap tech, and that eventually you have to have the turn, and that right. This is as good a time to have the turn as any. And we're in the early innings of that turn. I mean, this is essentially what Jay Polosky was saying in the interview that I had with him on RBDB.
Yeah, for people who haven't seen it, can you summarize his case?
Yeah, his case is that, you know, the markets are forward looking. You know, you buy the rumor, sell the news. The rumor is that we're going to have a vaccine very shortly. Pfizer came out with that. And the answer, therefore, based upon that, is to buy up in a massive way the names that have underperformed, leisure, hospitality, and travel, and then to sell the stay-at-home stocks, the likes of FANG. And then once the news hits, you know, then you can take your profits at that particular juncture. But, you know, we had such a massive move on Monday and Tuesday that we're already seeing people taking the profits. Does that mean that move doesn't have more legs? I think it does, but remember, we're in the middle of a pandemic. So, as I said, some companies are going to hit the wall. Going back to Jack's thesis about these three different stories in Europe and the United States, I think it's very much the case with Bill Ackman talking about, you know, shorting IG credit. Yeah, there are going to be some downgrades. We're not out of the woods yet, but still, nonetheless, I think that rotation does make some sense. But it's still very early days in that rotation.
Well, now seems like a good time to read through the closing numbers from the day. So Dow Jones Industrial Average closes at 29,397. That's off about 0.1%, 0.08% on the day. S&P 500 up about 0.75%, up to settle at 35,72. The NASDAQ, big mover of the day, closes at 11,786, up 2% on the day. Russell 2000, almost perfectly flat, plus 0.00% on the day.
Yeah, so a bit of a change there. So, you know,
yeah, a bit of a reversal, really, you could say. I mean, yeah. No, I was just going to say, you know, when I look at these, you know, I thought it was a great show yesterday with Tony Greer.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the reasons why I like having Tony on so much is because he's very much in a world that I'm not, which is the short-term trading piece, looking at flows, looking at and understanding short-term technical indicators. When I look at this, I think about this obviously more from a strategic standpoint, many ways similar to the way that you look at it. And for me, like, I just feel like if one of your coworkers comes in one day, and he's wearing like an official MLB jersey from the Yankees, and he's wearing a Yankees hat, and you're like, what's going on, man? He's like, I'm really into the Yankees now. You're like, all right, that's cool. But if he comes in the next day and he's just wearing head-to-toe Mets gear, I'm going to be like, is everything okay? And that's kind of the way I feel about these rotations. Like, I look at this and I understand that, you know, traders see short-term opportunity to move in and out of positions, but it just seems like there's a huge amount of churn happening in these markets. Like, there's no clear direction. And that, you know, some of the strategic stories that we're talking about, the virus, ultimately, some of the things that we're going to touch on a little later about liquidity in markets. These are much more longer term durable stories. They're not the kind of thing that turn on a week or a day or a short term cycle basis.
Yeah. And so I think that you know, that you make a lot of sense there. The thing is that we may be in a shift. I mean, if you think about this, everyone was saying that from a political perspective, we called this whole chaos theory too much, that actually now we know what the election outcome is going to be. And everyone who was talking about chaos after the election, they didn't know what they were talking about. You know, they bought all of these puts and these calls on the VIX, and exactly the opposite is happening because we know more. But actually, if you look at the real politics, it's we are in a position where one person, the incumbent president, is saying that he doesn't believe the election, and many other people are following along with him. So, you know, we actually have the outcome that people were talking about, a certain level of chaos post-election, yet stocks are up. So that does point to some other factors at play over the longer term, that, you know, shares want to go up. People, you know, are pushing into the markets irrespective of what's happening on the ground at any one particular time.
Right.
You know, on the economic, or rather on the political front, let me run something by you, actually, that we haven't discussed yet. I thought this was interesting. Someone was talking about when people talk about politics and the economy, one thing that comes out is tax policy. And I saw something on Twitter about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that became law in December 2017. AEI, which is generally considered a relatively conservative organization, they did a paper modeling, you know, what the implications are. And here's what they came out with. I thought this was kind of interesting. They say, in the longer run, as almost all the individual income tax provisions expire in 2025, most households experience a tax hike. However, once we account for the dynamic corporate impacts, most households see an increase in after-tax incomes, with higher income households experiencing significantly larger increases in after-tax incomes relative to lower income households. Now, let me tell you why I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about this because we're in the middle of a pandemic, where we have this so-called K-shaped recovery. People at the bottom echelon, they've just been crushed. People at the top are doing really well. And if we think back to 2017, what the AEI is basically saying is they're saying that, number one, the tax cuts as they were drafted are regressive. You know, more of the gains go to the top than to the bottom. Number two, they're saying that actually as drafted, those taxes are due to expire for the large majority of Americans by 2025.
The decreases are going to expire.
That's right. The tax decreases are going to go away.
Right.
And so you effectively have a tax hike in 2025 relative to the period before that. So we're now four to 5 years before, soon 4 years before that. What is the next administration going to do about this situation, given the baseline that I just mentioned, that pandemic, K-shaped recovery, et cetera? To me, that is the elephant in the room in terms of, you know, what's going to happen durably over the longer term.
Right.
So to the degree that people are talking about Trump, you know, not going along with the, you know, the transition, I think the real political issue is actually what happens in the next administration after January the 20th with tax policy. And this, to me, is the most important issue.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Well, Ed, these are excellent questions. AEI, of course, is American Enterprise Institute, not known for being a bastion of socialists, certainly. As you say, a bit to the right of center, it's probably fair to say. You know, Ed, listening to you talk through that, great points, and knowing you as well as I do, you must be thinking in the back of your mind about the MPS-MPC implications. This is the marginal propensity to save versus the marginal propensity to consume in upper-income households versus lower-income households. And as we remember from our macroeconomic textbooks, this has a considerable impact on aggregate demand in an economy. The short explanation for this is that when wealthy households receive more income, they tend to save or invest that income. When lower income households receive more income, they tend to spend it or pay down debt, which has a similar effect. So this is something that has not only political implications, but also, as exactly as I think you're suggesting, there are significant macroeconomic implications. You know, I would say to me, there's still some uncertainty with politics right now in this country, with the structure of where government is going to be in 2021. I mean, I expect, and you know, I don't usually give my opinions, but my expectation is that based on everything that I've read, watching politics for as long as I have, that this seems like eventually President Trump is going to have no choice but to concede, because it looks like there's just a very strong numerical case for the fact that he lost the election in the Electoral College, and that there's not going to be a reversal. You know, if you look at these stories about recounts and about when they go and they do these basically look back and go through these votes, you see changes of 50, 100, 150, right. 200 votes. Yeah. They're not multiple thousands of votes. And I think that the support, if you think about the politics here, and this is always a bit dangerous to speculate because you're thinking about optics, but it really seems to me like the people in the president's party, you know, they know their base is very positive for Trump. There's really not much downside for them to say, you know, I support the president. Let's let this play out through the courts. He has access to the courts. He has recourse to the courts. It's his right to go through this process. But when those moves start going against him, I think that they're going to break very quickly and accept Joe Biden as the next president of the United States. That's not my political opinion. That's just looking at the math and understanding the way politics generally works in this country. But the thing that's interesting to me is to think about this runoff election. I think it's January 5th, is it? In the state of Georgia, two Senate seats. This could be absolutely crucial. Fiscal policy, obviously the concern of Congress. So I think there's a lot of indeterminacy here, uncertainty around whether or not we have Mitch McConnell as Senate majority leader again for the next term between 2020 and 2022.
Yes, yeah, so I think in that and vein, I should say. You know, 21 and 23, I mean, in that vein, the question becomes, you know, on tax policy, at the margin, if you said, let's make the tax cuts for the, you know, for normal, ordinary Americans permanent, just like we did with the corporate side of things, that would mean that's not increasing the size of government, but it is going to increase deficits. Would a Republican Senate go along with that? Then on the other hand, Joe Biden has said, actually, I want to not just do that. I want to, you know, increase the progressivity of the tax base. I want to go back to the tax levels before the Trump tax cuts to, for those more wealthy Americans. Is a Republican Senate going to go along with that? So when you talk about marginal propensity to consume and to save, I think that's where we're getting into this whole concept of, you know, where's the money coming from? Who's going to get what they're getting? Even if you forget all about any sort of, you know, government spending, if you just look at it just from a purely taxational perspective, I think that this 2017 bill, which was highly regressive in terms of its impact, that it can be undone. But will it be undone given the politics? I think that it's highly dubious. So, going back to our whole conversation about what the impact of the pandemic is going to be on the economy, it's the jury's still out in terms of what the impact is. But increasingly, as the numbers of COVID cases tick up, all of these issues are going to come into play. And to the degree that it does have a negative impact, you're going to need to have some sort of fiscal response. And these are the issues that I think are the most important to think about in regard to that response. Going forward.
Yeah, extremely well said, Ed. I should say, just in the interest of obviously, we don't just present one side of the story. Some things that I thought were very heartening today. Dr. Anthony Fauci was speaking at, I think, a Financial Times conference and had some very positive things to say about the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine and said that he expects similar results from another U.S. biotech company called Moderna. Because their vaccine is substantively similar to the Pfizer vaccine, and so the potential for more positive data coming out for a second vaccine, which obviously is something that all of us are hoping and praying for.
Yeah, so I mean, the markets should be forward looking, but they can't look too far forward because we're about to hit a wave that will have some disparate impact on companies. And I think particularly in those sectors of the economy that people had been rotating into on Monday and Tuesday. The next thing on my mind, I think, which you foreshadowed before, was the liquidity.
Yeah.
Because there's a piece that's coming out tomorrow with Michael Howell. I spoke to him, and basically he's pretty bullish on 2021. And the reason that he's so bullish is because of a global wave of liquidity. We're not talking about just the U.S., but we're talking globally. What he's seen is a massive wave of liquidity relative to the previous numbers. So we're talking about a 15% increase in liquidity, and the concomitant increase in asset prices hasn't come. And so he sees asset prices shooting up in 2021. And let me just take a look at my notes from that conversation here. Howell said, based upon that he believes that Bitcoin will hit 25,000 and that gold will hit 2,500 and yields will hit 2%. On the back of inflation as this takes hold in 2021. So very big calls on his part. I think it's a must-watch interview. And I think that it's definitely going against the grain of some of the things that I've been talking about, at least over the short to medium term. He's thinking 2021 is going to be positive because the wall of liquidity will just overwhelm everything else.
Yeah. And I'm not even going to try and hide this one. This is just a shameless plug. It's a great interview. I got to see a portion of it earlier today. You did a great job asking these questions, really digging in. Mike Howell, one of my favorite Real Vision guests, he's been looking at precisely these issues for 30 years now, I think going back to his days at Salomon Brothers, and a really deep analytic look that you walk through with Mike Howell. Some numbers that struck me: global liquidity up $20 trillion. That's a quarter of global GDP. Central banks have put in $6 billion so far and increased their balance sheets by a third. That is for the time period, I believe, just 2020. He talks about relatively low exposure to equity by investors. And then which is the point that you're talking about now, the potential for upside there. But interestingly enough, one of the things we talk about on this show so often is looking at things across different time horizons. This idea that we are building this liquidity debt axis that has the potential to create a liquidity and debt spiral. He said, I thought one of the most ominous phrases, which was, every turn of the spiral raises credit risks. Liquidity is papering over the cracks, and debt is wonderful collateral until it isn't.
Well, you know, the thing is, he was, I think, positive in a way that Bill Ackman's not, because I think that the story is he's saying 2021 is shaping up to be bullish, and those cracks will be papered over. So to the degree that you have refinancing risk, which is what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He believes that the powers that be will step in to fill those holes, to fill those gaps. So IG credit, it's not going to be a problem. Maybe you might have some problems in junk, but he believes that they will step in. You know, the way that I'm looking at it, because on the liquidity side, you're looking at, banks, and you're looking at central banks pumping money in. That's the supply. Then you have the assets that they're buying. You know, we're talking about world assets, global assets. You could buy houses. you could buy gold, you can buy financial assets, the whole bit. So he's looking at a global system, and he's looking at global liquidity and world asset prices. And what he's seeing, therefore, is you know, because money is fungible and you can, it can go in different places, the way to think about it is if the money is there to buy something, then the more of that you have, the higher the prices will go. That's right. That's in a nutshell what's happening. So if you have over the course of 2020 global liquidity going up almost 20%, it's almost a guarantee that world asset prices have to go up in concert with that, and they've yet to do so thus far. And this is his case for why things will go up in 2021. And if you look at it just at a micro level, what does that mean? That means that you have to paper over the cracks. That means that when problems come up, the central banks will step in and provide that liquidity to get over the cracks. And as a result, it'll keep the wave moving forward. So very, very interesting thesis. I'm not sure where I stand on that, what I believe, but I found it very fascinating, interesting. And I just found it something that to put into my register as to how to think about the world.
Yeah, that's a very well contextualized vision of a very complicated and analytic thesis that Mike puts forward. You know, to your point, it seems as though he's certainly more bullish in the short term than, say, Bill Ackman is on credit, but may actually ultimately be more bearish in the long term. With that said, I should probably say it's just way too complex and nuanced to summarize here. It's like an hour-long interview. Definitely check it out. This is much-see watching for anyone who is a serious nerd on financial markets, Ed Harrison and Mike Howell.
So, I mean, that in a nutshell is everything that I'm thinking about. There are one or two other things that are on my mind right now, but I think that we have if I could sum it up, in the United States, we have relatively good lagging to coincident data, and we have a torrent of coronavirus cases going forward. At the same time, we have a monster amount of global liquidity that has hit the economy, which is waiting there to buy up asset prices, whether it be houses, whether it be, you know, financial assets. And so this is a situation where you have a lot of moving parts that are moving in opposite directions at the same time. So I think that we're at a specifically critical juncture in all of this, not just politically, but also in terms of, you know, where the market is headed over the medium term. So I don't have a specific view as to how this is going to play out. I do think that there are more risks to the downside than there are upside, but Michael Howell's giving you a reason to believe the opposite.
Yeah, so take a look. You will enjoy this piece.
So Ash, as always, thank you. And I think that's it for us this week. You're talking to Raoul on Friday. We'll be back at it on Monday.
Yes, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.